With our special guest tonight, Chuck Mishler. He is live. He's in New Zealand. We are in St. Louis today. And we will be back in a moment to talk about deception, the book of Revelation, and end time prophecy right here on Coast to Coast AM. Chuck, why this apparent deception? Why this demonic deception? What's their mission? What's their goal? What do they want?
Well, that's one of the things that the whole name Satan means is our accuser. And the whole thing has to do with the whole cosmic warfare in which his agenda, Satan's agenda. First of all, Satan, there's two mistakes you can make about him. One is to assume he doesn't exist.
Right.
And the other is to get so terrified that you don't realize the resources we have against him. But the point is, anyone that doesn't believe he's real, all they have to do is try opposing him for a while. But clearly, his agenda is to thwart the plan of God. And that begs them the question to really understand what God's plan is. But that plan, of course, is all centered around the person of the one that we call Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Messiah, Yeshua HaMashiach. And but his agenda is one of deceit. And that started back in Genesis 3, where he deceived Eve on that very issue. And if you study his methods all the way through Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, you discover that his primary agenda is one of deception. And that's why, as we discover that these UFO things have an agenda of deception, that speaks volumes to someone that is biblically literate, if you will. And so, but that's the agenda. And to understand that agenda, it begs a different question. You really need to understand what God's plan is. And God's plan is all centered around a person. You know, as you study the Bible, you got 66 books penned by 40 guys and so forth. That is an integrated message. But as you study that integrated message, you discover that every page, every detail, always points to a particular person.
Mm-hmm.
The person, right, of the Creator himself, who chose to enter his creation and perform a mission on our behalf. And everything that happens in the universe is measured by that mission and its success. And so that sounds very strange at first until one really gets into it. But the point is that lifetime, the lifetime of Christ, being incarnate, becoming a man, and fulfilling a destiny that man on his own could not achieve. And to pay our price, if you will, to make it possible for us to end up eternally having a... See, boy, this gets into a whole other area. The whole idea that you and I are eternal, whether we're saved or not, is a shocking discovery. You see, we know today from Einstein's theory of relativity that time is a physical property.
Right.
We tend
right.
to... Yeah, and so time varies, the mass acceleration of gravity and so forth. Well, the point is, when we think of eternity, we visualize that as God having lots of time, when in fact that's good poetry in terms of our songs and things, but it's bad physics. God is not someone... Is God subject to gravity? Hardly. Is he subject to the constraints of mass or acceleration? Of course not. So God is not... He's not subject to the restrictions of mass. Neither are you or me. You and me... See, I can't see you. If I was standing right across, I could only see the temporary residence you're in. I'm sitting here with a laptop computer, and if you knew everything there is to know about every resistor, every transistor, every part of the hardware, you still couldn't tell me about its behavior, because that hardware is simply an environment in which the software resides. The real behavior of that computer, in every respect, is a result of the software that's in it. Now, software has no mass. Software can travel, we can send it through the airwaves, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, so the real you, the real George Nuri, is software, not hardware. You are temporarily resident in a body, yes, but the real you, call it soul, spirit, give it fancy labels if you like,
sure,
but the real you is software, not hardware, which means, by the way, the real you has no mass. The real you is eternal, whether you realize it or not. The challenge is, where will you spend it? And you and I have no capacity to imagine what being separated from God really means. We think of death, which is the separation of the body and the soul. And we call that physical death. But we have no grasp of the second death, which is separation of the soul and the spirit. And so that's the minute you get into those discussions, you now are dealing with a hyperspace, a space beyond the four dimensions that we are normally conversant with, length, width, height, and time. We know, our particle physicists tell us today, that they now know that we live in 10 dimensions. Four are directly perceptible, but six of them are inferable only by indirect means. And that's the boundary discussions in particle physics today, but it also is exactly what the Bible's been saying all along. Paul, in his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 3, verse 18, lists the four dimensions that we presently acknowledge or experience. But so what I guess what I'm saying is the whole issue that the Bible deals with is the real reality. You know, there's a very fascinating article in Scientific American in 2005 in the June issue talking about the constancy of constants. One of the frontiers in modern science is they're discovering that the things that we have taken for granted are constants in physics, Planck's constant and other things. They're discovering that those constants are not really constant. There are all kinds of experiments trying to challenge that. It turns out, though, interesting words used in that article. If the constants of science are changing, then that demonstrates that our reality is but a subset of a larger reality. And that's their words, not mine. But I was fascinated by that because that's exactly what the Bible has been trying to get across to us all along, is that what we think of as physical reality is a subset of a larger reality. And the real destiny of all of us has to do with that larger reality. And that's what the Bible spends its energies trying to communicate to us. And there is a warfare going on in that hyperspace, if you will. And hyperspace is just a name for something with more than three or four dimensions, obviously. But the point is, there's a warfare, and there's combat going on. And that's exactly what we get glimpses of as we explore from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22. And, of course, one of the climactic passages, of course, is the one that you want to introduce in here to get into the book of Revelation, which is the unveiling. And most people don't read the first sentence. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him. Who gave to what? It's the revelation of Jesus Christ, the unveiling of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him. To whom? Jesus Christ. And he, Christ, sent and signified it, rendered it into signs unto his servant John. And so the unveiling of the whole drama is all encapsulated in that last book. Like most textbooks in college, all the answers are in the back. And that last book is the summary of the whole enchilada. In fact, one of the most interesting studies a person can do is to contrast the details of Genesis, the first book, with the details of Revelation at the end, and you discover that they're all designed to anticipate each other. And so, that's the climax we're moving into.
And you had mentioned earlier, though, to stay away from Ouija boards. Tie that into all of this. Is that part of the instrumentation?
That's called an entry. See, there's another thing. There's another subtlety here. If we're going to get into this, let's be very, I think it's useful for us to be very precise, okay? And we use the word demonic connotatively to mean this general area we're talking about. But when we use the word demon denotatively, we discover there's some distinctive differences between a fallen angel and a demon. The fallen angels, we know a lot about angels if we study the Bible. You discover that they can materialize. They can lead people by the hand. They can indulge in combat. We are told in the New Testament that many have entertained angels unawares. In other words, they apparently can manifest themselves in a way that we think is just another person. So angels are powerful creatures in that they can materialize, they can do a lot of different things. Demons, as we encounter them in the New Testament, are rather strange. because they appear to be powerless except to the extent they can indwell someone. They seem to seek embodiment, and to get that embodiment requires permission, and we can inadvertently give them permission. That's what's called an entry, technically. And when we mess around with, say, a Ouija board, that's inviting an entry. I remember when Dr. Walter Martin, I was very close to him. I was on his board of directors. We were good friends. He was probably the greatest living expert in comparative religion alive, passed away some years ago. But the point is, he set out to attack William Blatty's book when he did The Exorcist. And he was quite startled to discover that William Blatty had done his homework, that novel, called The Exorcist, was actually built on a combination of several case studies. It wasn't a gal. The original one was a guy in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But the point is, he actually built the novel on actual documented case studies. And that startled Walter, because it turned out that Blatty had done his homework. In any case, without getting into the novel itself, what's interesting, if you recall that story, it all started in the novel, it was a girl, fooling around with a Ouija board. And that was an entry. And that's why some of these things that lore, it takes a volitional entry for these creatures to do their mischief. And they're dangerous. And these things can get out of control. In fact, there's a very bizarre episode in the Bible at Gadara, where the disciples in Christ, they encounter this demon-possessed guy, and he's exorcised there, of course. But the point is, it turns out that the demons, there were more than one, there's in fact several thousand of them, that begged. They recognized who Christ was, which is interesting. They're sentient. They understood who he was, and they also knew what their destiny was. And they plead with him to be allowed to enter the herd of swine that are nearby. And strangely, Christ gives them that permission, and they do. And then they run off the cliff and they drown in the Sea of Galilee. When you read that episode in the Bible, it's really bizarre.
Yes.
And you wonder, why did they want that, and why did he let them do that? And it's my presumption, just my presumption, that the reason he did is to communicate to us that these creatures are real and that they're subject to certain kinds of rules. And they needed permission to enter the swine, which is bizarre. In other words, they couldn't do that without that permission. And apparently, they can't enter or do damage to us unless we allow them. Now, the way we allow them is to be fooling around in something that we're not equipped to deal with, and playing with Ouija boards or seeking communication with that other world is dangerous, because that other world harbors sentient, powerful beings whose agenda is hostile to our own, and we need to understand that. And so there's two mistakes you can make in this area. One is to ignore it and think it's not real. The other one is to get so terrified of it, not to realize that in all these things, God has a remedy, and that remedy is always in the person of his son. And that's part of the drama that is going on. That's part of the drama that we as individuals find ourselves confronted with from time to time. So that's what, when you start talking about the Nephilim, you're in that gray area where it's the result of the mischief of these fallen angels. Now, that leads to all kinds of conjectures. Some people speculate. Now, this is just in the area of scholastic conjecture here.
Sure.
But there are experts that suspect that the demons derive from the Nephilim that drowned in the flood. In other words, somehow these fallen angels back in Genesis 6 developed a technology by which they could create hybrids. See, angels can't reproduce humans, because humans can. And so by creating the hybrids, it was a way for them to multiply their forces. Okay, the flood comes and the Nephilim drown. Great. But what happened to the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim? And the conjecture by some scholars is that those disembodied Nephilim, if you will, are the source of the demons that we encounter in the New Testament and places in the Old also. So the point is that we're now moving in an area of scholastic conjectures in which many good scholars would disagree. They're very competent scholars. They would, if they're hearing me now, say, that's Chuck's view, but they have a different view, and that's fine. I usually join where two people agree, one is redundant, right? But to discern the difference between demons and fallen angels, I think is scripturally defendable. My professional background is in the information sciences, and I personally have come to the view that there are no true synonyms. Two words can be synonymous in that they mean almost the same thing. But watch out for that word almost, because in the difference can be a discovery. And I think very often we get confused scholastically because we fail to be precise. And one of the things I've discovered in my 60 years of biblical study is that there's a value in being very, very precise. I think God means what he says and says what he means. And it's the move towards precision. That's one reason why the composition of Hebrew on the one hand in the Old Testament and the Greek in the New is so useful, because those two languages are structurally very, very distinctively different, almost antithetical. And the combination of them can be incredibly powerful.
Chuck, I'm going to have you interpret the Book of Revelation for us when we come back in just a moment. But let's just take a moment. For people who are interested in what you do and your website and the books and the DVDs that you've put out, what do? Where do they go?
Well, our publishing ministry is called Koinonia House. Koinonia is the Greek word for communication or fellowship. So Koinonia House is our publishing entity. It's headquartered in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It has a website called khouse.org, khouse.org. And all of our materials, of course, are available there on downloads or whatever. We're one of the largest electronic publishers in the fundamental Christian field. We also have, though, another website that is our campus. We have an online think tank that anyone can be part of if they choose to. It's a volunteer organization. We have members in 70 countries now. That's a different website. It's called studycenter.com, studycenter.com. That's a campus. On that website, there is a thing called a handbook that you can download or take a look at, which explains how the think tank works. It's more than just being able to take courses for credit or what have you. It's also has an intelligence network you can be part of. It has resources that you can be part of. It's a campus. The reason it's a think tank is because the work product of the members becomes part of the resources that are available. We don't deal in term papers. We deal in multimedia presentations. It's simpler for one of our members to put together a five-minute bullet briefing in PowerPoint than it is to do a term paper. So the intelligence database has 17 different media types, film clips, whatever. And it's fed by most of the major intelligence services. So the intelligence network is part. We have studies in the Bible, which we call the Berean studies, and it's verse by verse, the entire Bible in great depth. And that's probably our hallmark. That's our primary foundation, of course. That eclipses everything else. But the second avenue of study that parallels that, we call the biblical thing the Berean avenue of study. The Issachar Avenue, to be like the sons of Issachar, who understood the times and knew what their country had to do.
All right, hold on for a second, Chuck. We're at the break already. Fast show. We'll be back. Well, next hour, our final hour with Chuck Mishler. We'll take your phone calls. We'll come back in just a moment to have him interpret the Book of Revelation for us, the Apocalypse, next on Coast to Coast AM. The Book of Revelation, Chuck, some call it the Apocalypse. Interpret this for us. Is it a message? Is it something for us to use as a guide to change our lifestyles, or is it something that will happen?
Well, all of the above. I think that it's interesting. It's the only book in the Bible that has the audacity that says, read me, I'm special. All through the Bible, you find admonitions to read the Bible in a collective sense, but only one book in the entire collection of 66 of them says, read me, I'm special, and if you do, you get a special blessing. and it makes that commitment several times in its pages. And the discovery that you need to make is that that book is in signs, and every, in other words, if I can code, but every sign or every sememe, if you will, is alluded to somewhere else in the Bible. In other words, it takes for granted that you have the rest of the Bible at your fingertips, because every phrase, every idiom that it uses is explained somewhere else in the Scripture. So it becomes a treasure hunt. As you study the book of Revelation, every time it uses a phrase or an identity of some kind, that is explained somewhere else in Scripture. And you quickly discover, as you study the book then, that it ties together all the rest. And so it's like a treasure hunt. I remember I first encountered a lecturer that pointed out to me when I was a teenager, and that's a long time ago. It's more than six decades ago. The point is, that put me on a treasure hunt that I've spent the rest of my life on. And the more you study the book, the more you start developing a respect for the precision of the idioms that it uses from all the rest of it. And that's probably one of the reasons it's such a rich blessing, is you begin to realize that the entire package, not just the book of Revelation, but the total 66 books, starting with Genesis 1 all the way through, is a deliberately designed package. And the ribbon on that, so to speak, is the last book, the book of Revelation. The first chapter introduces 24 identities of Jesus Christ. And those 24 identities then are used all through the rest of the book to tie things together. The most important chapters of the book are chapters 2 and 3, because that deals with seven churches. And those seven churches typify and model and identify the entire church age from the time of Acts chapter 2 all the way through to the end. And so the part that is relevant for you and me is in chapter 2 and 3. From chapter 4 on is this climactic, wild end-time drama that is yet ahead of us. But the part of it that we directly are involved in, directly connected to, is chapters 2 and 3. So, strangely enough, those two chapters are the most important in the book from a practical point for you and me. The speculations of a lot of the rest of it are interesting, but really secondary to our primary purpose. But the book obviously deals with the climax of the planet Earth, and the climax of man's inability to govern himself. And you alluded to that earlier today, that we're seeing the geopolitical crises increase worldwide. Sure. The world is conditioning itself for a leader that's going to give them security, and that leader is going to lead us to the ultimate form of tyranny. And that's one of the things the Bible warns us through all the way through, and that the world is going to embrace a form of tyranny that'll be disastrous. And that is the ultimate climax that is interrupted, of course, by the return of Christ himself. But in the meantime, man wants to run things himself, and he's going to discover that he can't. And right in the middle of this, of course, you have Satan preparing his super guy in the wings, and that'll be coming forward. And I think it's a waste of time to speculate on him because of some intervening events. But I think the book of Revelation is probably, in my own experience of more than six decades of this kind of study, it's the most fruitful and rewarding of all the studies in the Bible. To study it properly will take you into most of the rest of the Bible. But the point is, it's a great place to start if you go at it with respect and assume it knows and take it for what it says. Be careful of allegories. Allegories are a license to invent. You want to understand what those idioms mean, but the way you unravel what those idioms mean is to find out where else they're used in the Bible. One of the most powerful tools that you can have in Bible study is a concordance. That's an index of if you've got a phrase or a word, it shows you every place it occurs, and that's a way you can track down some concept. If you're trying to take a particular word, it'll show you every place that is used throughout the scripture, and that's one of the ways you track back from a particular reference in the book of Revelation where else it's used. And you discover very quickly that the consistency of use of those idioms are astonishing, independent of who the author is. In other words, you got these 40 different authors that over the 2,000 years that have been writing, but you discover their use of idioms is consistent and it often includes truths that were far beyond the horizon of the guy that was writing it. And you begin to realize that it was superintended, if you will, supernaturally.
And when you discover that,
it changes your whole perspective.
Tell us about the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, the four horsemen, of course, have become an idiom in literature. But obviously, what's going to be unleashed here is four forces, if you will. The first one is the guy on a white horse, and he's the guy that many people misunderstand. That's not Christ. That's the false Christ that comes, because he's riding in bad company.
Mm-hmm.
He's, hell and death ride with him. And then you've got the green horse, the pale horse, the chloros horse, which is inflation and famine. And you also discover, if you study famine throughout history, you discover that it's more often than not a political tool, not a real shortage of something. It's something that's been induced for some other agenda purpose. But in any case, those four horsemen are the ones that lead to the chaos that's going to surface this leader that goes by in many titles. He has 33 different titles in the Old Testament, 13 in the New. We typically call him the Antichrist, but that's a misnomer in a sense, because in the Antichristos in the Greek really means in the place of. Yes, he's against Christ, but the real concept in the Greek is that he's in the place of Christ, and he's the one that the world embraces in lieu of the one they should be embracing. And he's the one that's going to bring, obviously, disaster. And the nature of those disasters, of course, are codified in chapter 6 through 19, the main bulk of the book. And things get straightened out at the end, of course, in chapter 19 through the end, 20, 21, 22. So without getting into the choice of idioms, each of those idioms is a fascinating study of its own right. We published a commentary which takes 24 one-hour sessions with diagrams to go through the whole book, if you will. So it's hard to take it in pieces in just a few sound bites on a AM broadcast. But the point is, the real message of them, though, is to recognize that the entire book is in code, but every code is expressed and anticipated elsewhere in the Bible. And in my mind, there's a number of reasons why the book is such an incredible blessing to anyone that reads it. But one of the main blessings is that you begin to discover the elegance of the design of the entire package. And once you get into that, it's the good news is addictive. It starts a lifetime journey of study.
Are we seeing these conditions occurring now, Chuck? For example, the conditions of the four horsemen. Are we seeing these events now?
I don't know. I know those events are very specific and yet future. But I think we can see the geopolitical horizon line itself up for that. That's sort of introducing another topic here in terms of what's coming next. But I think if someone is trying to figure out where are we on God's calendar, you always look at Israel. Israel is the key. It's interesting. Israel is not one of the nations. In the Bible, it's Israel and the nations as two groups. Israel is the focus. The nations is a term used of all the rest, if you will. But Israel's predicament it's interesting. Israel's origin, its ups, its downs, and its entire destiny is all laid out in advance. And if you really understand that from a scriptural point of view, you can tell where you are in God's calendar by what's going on in the Middle East. Now, in the Middle East, Israel is increasingly being alone. Obviously, even America is going to be a big disappointment in terms of its support of Israel for a lot of reasons. But clearly, they don't have any friends. And that shouldn't surprise us, because that's exactly what the Bible portrays. And it's going to get worse, actually, before it gets better. And
but it will get better.
It will get better. They are that one of the as you look at each of the passages in each of the so-called minor prophets. Some, by the way, the smaller books, they're minor or major by in terms of the size of the books. But many of the real gemstones in the scripture are these little books, the so-called minor prophets in the Old Testament, that are astonishingly descriptive of what's going on. But I think there's a time coming where Israel is going to be. In Psalm 83, there's a profile of the nations that surround Israel, their immediate neighbors, that are going to be confederated to wipe Israel off the map. That's what's described in Psalm 83. Many people who study prophecy are very enamored with the passages in Ezekiel 38 and 39, the so-called Gog-Magog thing. And that's also, I think, on the horizon. But I think what comes ahead of that is the Psalm 83 series of events. And that gets complicated to try to unravel all of that. But the point is, if you really understand Psalm 83, and if you really understand Ezekiel 38 and 39, I think those are two episodes that are going to occur prior to the big climax that's described in Revelation 6 and following. The four horsemen and all of that are idiomatically, they're often used poetically as broad brush descriptors, but actually in the book, in Revelation chapter 6 and following, the four horsemen refer to a specific series of events that will follow gathering of the church and all of that. So and obviously, we're getting into areas that will be looked at very differently depending on how precise the scholar looks at the book. The view I'm expressing is a view that takes the Bible very literally. And there are people who take the Bible more allegorically or softer, and obviously they will have different perspectives. But the perspective that I'm espousing or have embraced is one that takes it very precisely, very literally, and with great precision in terms of the forms of expression.
Up until the book of Revelation, which is the future, everything was already written about has occurred, correct?
No. There's a lot of things in the Old Testament too that have not yet happened.
Okay.
I'll give you the destruction of Damascus, for an example. Everybody's wondering in Isaiah 17, verse 1, the destruction of Damascus is described. Damascus is the longest uninterrupted population in the planet Earth. The destruction the Bible talks about hasn't happened yet. I'll give you a more controversial one, and that's the city of Babylon. The city of Babylon has a destiny in the scripture that is yet to happen. In Isaiah 13 and 14, and in Jeremiah 50:51, it describes Babylon as a major power center on the planet Earth that's going to be destroyed in an hour, dramatically, catastrophically.
That's got to be nuclear. It's the only way, right?
Well, probably. But the point is, once it's destroyed, it'll never again be, even the building materials won't be reused. Jeremiah and Isaiah both are very explicit on that. Now, in the book of Revelation, the word Babylon is used in some ways that can be much, some people make allegories out of that. I happen to believe that they're all true. The allegorical implications that many people see, I don't disagree with. But I look to Isaiah and Jeremiah, the precision that it's the city on the banks of the Euphrates. Now, in order for the biblical scenario to transpire, that implies that Babylon has to reemerge on the world scene to be a major player. Now, I love this example because there's no evidence of that yet. Babylon has been in part rebuilt. Saddam Hussein spent millions of dollars rebuilding portions of it. And the point is, the building materials have been reused. You can go visit there. It's a tourist attraction to go tour and see the rebuilt ancient Babylon, parts of it. And so the point is, the destruction and the conditions in Isaiah and Jeremiah that are so intensely described have yet to happen, which means that if we take the Bible seriously, that Babylon has a destiny yet to reemerge somehow on the world scene. And I love this because there is no evidence. It's not like I'm trying to interpret something going on in biblical terms. Quite the contrary. I'm trying to do just the opposite. What does the Bible really describe that's going to happen? Is it happening? Not yet. But if I'm correct, then it will be. And it's my view that sometime, maybe next month, maybe next year, who goes somewhere downstream, for reasons yet that are not apparent, Babylon is going to reemerge to meet a major, major power center on the planet Earth. Now, I would be insincere with you if I didn't share with you some rumbles that are going on.
Okay.
There are some white papers circulating in the Beltway think tanks that are speculating that the UN might move there. See, the UN has got a problem in New York because they need more space and there isn't more space, and they need to expand, they feel. The New Yorkers would like them to get out of there because it's a nightmare to try to manage the situation there in New York. The UN would like to get out of there. Many Americans would like them to get out of there. Well, if the UN was to move, where would you move it? It wouldn't go to London, Paris, or Rome, because it's really the European Union is more of a rival than a partner. And so if you were going to place the UN somewhere, where would you put it? Well, one view is that you would sit back and figure out what is the biggest challenge to the planet Earth over the next 30 or 40 years. The answer is energy. Well, why not plant the UN right in the middle of the oil patch? And the idea of moving it back to Babylon has been one suggestion that has been bandied about. Why? Well, that would replace the American troops with UN troops. It would stabilize the regime, presumably. It would be a major trophy for the Muslim interests. It would be welcomed by many Americans to get it out of here, and so forth. So one can paint, you can actually make a list of a number of benefits to almost everybody involved, so it has some appeal. Now, there are some rumbles I hear that it wouldn't surprise me if some of these things start to happen. But the point is, in terms of our present geopolitical horizon, there's no real serious evidence of it happening yet, but if I'm correct, then it will happen. Somehow, Babylon needs to reemerge to be a primary power on the world geopolitical horizon in order to have Jeremiah 50 and 51 take place, Isaiah 13 and 14 take place, etc. And I mention this because if somewhere in coming months, you see some kind of serious consideration to the reemergence of the UN moving to Babylon or whatever.
Right.
Remember, you heard it here on Coast to Coast First. You know?
All right. Chuck, stay with us. We're going to come up to the top of the hour. And when we do come back, it'll be an hour of your phone calls now with Chuck Mishler right here on Coast to Coast AM.